This episode contains descriptions of graphic body horror and references to harm against minors. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. The following is an excerpt from Georgia Wood Pangborn's The Substitute, where a young mother reveals her fears about raising her children. What becomes of children when fathers and mothers die? Sometimes things turn out all right, I know. It isn't always the same as when parent birds are shot and the nestlings starve. But sometimes it's like that. When there are no relatives to take them and no money has been left for their support, what happens when a little girl is left without a mother to tell her about growing up? Hi everyone, I'm Alastair Murden, and this is Haunted Places Ghost Stories, a Spotify original from Parcast. Ghost stories have arisen from every century and every corner of the world, from the streets of Victorian Whitechapel to the temples of Japan. Whether seated around the campfire or curled up with a pair of headphones, we return to them time and again to feel our skin crawl and our hearts race. Episodes of Ghost Stories are inspired by classic short stories from some of history's greatest authors. The following version is our own unique take. It may feel familiar in some ways and different in others. We hope you enjoy it. You can find episodes of Ghost Stories and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. Georgia Wood Pangborn, author of 1914's The Substitute, wasn't as prolific as other writers we've covered, but to be fair, she was also homeschooling her children Edgar and Mary while she wrote. Edgar went on to become a noted genre fiction writer in the 1950s, and he likely owes his talent to his mother. The short stories Georgia published are a potent mix of poetry and horror, showing her promise as a contributor to the genre. And her 1914 short story, The Substitute, is an eerie meditation on longing and motherhood. There's a lot of rhetoric around having it all: the spotless house, the high-powered job, the perfect partner, and in many cases, children. And every year, billions of people track their fertility, worried they'll lose their chance, even if they're not sure if they want it at all. Motherhood is scary, for when you commit to that choice, you're signing up for life. And in some very tragic cases, for death too. I will tell today's story from the point of view of Anna Marston, the self-described old maid at 32 living by the seashore. She believes motherhood has passed her by, but a strange visit from an old friend reveals that Anna's desires are far more attainable than she thinks, and more dangerous. We'll receive a surprise visit from an old friend after this. Long ago, in quieter days, there was nothing I loved more than a summer evening on the beach. I got lonely at times, the price I paid for holding out for true love, but there was always the vivid pink and purple sunset to cheer me up. There was always the sound of children's laughter under the rising moon. My house on the beach sat beside a children's convalescent home run by a kind, steely former New Yorker named Mrs. Van Dyne. The sea air did the sick children good, and I often heard them playing from my balcony perch. I had no children of my own. I'm not sure if I envied mothers, but I sometimes dreamed of the life I could have had. I'd think back to a time before my mind was made up, or perhaps before my hand was forced. When I was in college, and the whole world lay before me and my friends. One night recently, a parade of women in their 20s walked by the house. I heard them chatter, their laughter and protest rising and falling like ocean swells. Talking about romance and politics, swearing to be modern women in all their affairs. All the things I used to say to my friends. They reminded me of my closest friend, Mary Hannaford. Years before, when Mary told me she was getting married, I could only think of how cold the sand was between my toes. I asked to borrow her shoes. Oh, how that annoyed her. I thought I was being funny, but now I know I just wasn't ready for her to grow up and leave me. She'd found a prince in Calvin Barclay while I was kissing frogs. I never stopped kissing them until the frogs stopped coming to call. Our paths diverged. Mary moved inland, beyond the rail line's reach. Her letters became infrequent, and then they stopped altogether. I hadn't thought of her in a decade, but she sprung to mind that night. With all that youthful optimism in front of me, it was hard not to think of a time when I believed in those simple joys too. I heard my porch steps creak behind me. No one had visited me in my big old house for a long time, except for the occasional neighbor asking for a cup of flour or an extra towel. When I turned to look, surprise stole the breath from my lungs. It was Mary Hannaford. She looked nearly the same as she did a decade before. The dim light of the stars hid any sign of age on her skin. Her hair was thick and silky, her arms toned. She belonged on the cover of Harper's, modelling the latest fashions, or, given the pale glow of her skin, perhaps playing a tragic heroine on stage. Yet here she was in front of me for the first time in years. Tears pricked my eyes. I took a shaky breath. Time had not been as kind to me. I had dark circles under my eyes. My body was bony in places where one wants to be plump, and plump in places where one wants to see bone. I was no ingenue. Still, Mary wouldn't care. I smiled and moved to embrace her, but she pulled away, taking a seat near the stairs. I tried not to take it personally. I could mend the rift. I laughed. Mary Hannaford, you gave me such a fright. She smiled, as though she had a secret. It's Mary Barclay now. I'm not the girl you once knew. I am my own woman. I laughed. You were always your own woman. You certainly didn't need a man's ring to prove that. There we were again, talking romance and politics. Mary's smile dimmed. She turned to the beach, listening for something in the distance. I followed her gaze, only to find one of those young women staring at me with the most peculiar expression. I wondered why she was looking at me that way. Mary's voice startled me from my pondering. Calvin died 3 years ago, she said abruptly. Then she sniffled. My face fell. I had no idea. I wish she wasn't sitting so far away. I wanted to dry her tears. Mary continued. I wanted to write you when it happened, but I didn't have the words. You see, I wasn't my own woman then. I depended on him too much. When he died, all I was left with was a pile of debt and two young children. I wanted to empathize, but I worked as my father's secretary, and I inherited a small fortune when my mother passed. I'd never struggled for money and thus could only imagine the hardships she'd suffered. If only she had reached out to me, I would have happily paid for anything she wanted. But she didn't, so all I could say was, I'm so sorry. Mary fiddled with her hands. I could just barely make out a crisscross of scars on them. She caught me staring and pulled them behind her back. It's nothing, just an injury from the machines at the garment factory. I'm one of the lucky ones. I've only gotten caught 4 or 5 times. I shivered. Mary always had such delicate hands, and now they were marred by her work. I found myself only able to utter another apology. I'm sorry, I told her. I'd already said it, but I couldn't help repeating it. Still, something unsaid hung between us like a great blade. Mary's eyes lingered on me. Then she spoke again. The last time I was feeding threads into the machine, the skin between my thumb and my index finger got caught. I tried to pull my hand out and my grip slipped. The needle went straight through my hand and the thread with it. There was so much blood. Her face went red. It stung so badly, and I was afraid to ask for help because I couldn't lose my job. I have to do what I can for my children. She pulled her hands in front of her now, and I wish I could reach over to clasp them. Mary wiped her eyes. A girl on the floor used to work in a hospital. She tended me up as best she could, but it still aches. When I got home, my children didn't even notice I was injured. They just wanted to know why I was late. I was stunned. Their mother had given up so much for them, and these children never considered that she might be in pain? My hand moved to turn on the light so I could see better, but Mary shrank away like I'd burned her. "Don't, Anna, please. Let us stay in the dusk for now." I nodded and told her that her children would grow to understand what she'd done for them. She sighed. "Probably not. But that is not their duty. Their children." I told her that seemed very unfair. She conceded, "It is. But you still have to take care of them." Mary laughed bitterly. "But I can't even manage that. I salvaged my hand, but I had to pay for that. Then when Martha and Benny got sick, I didn't have the money to care for them." I looked at the children on the beach, the ones from Mrs. Van Dyne's convalescent home. I thought of offering to pay for Mary's children to stay there. The next words from her mouth sounded like she'd read my mind. "I brought them to Mrs. Van Dyne. I don't have enough to pay her, but she accepts what I can give. I hope to God that they will survive once the weather gets colder. I don't know what I'll do if they don't." The desperation in her voice frightened me. "I'll help. However you need me, I'll help." The words flew out of my mouth before I'd thought them through. But the relief on her face was enough to convince me I'd done the right thing. It was fate that she and the children had ended up so close to me. Mary looked lighter now. She sat up straighter and smiled, looking exactly like the girl I'd known at college. "Oh, thank you, Anna. Let's go visit with them now." She bounded down the steps before I could put on my shoes. I bent to pull them on my feet as quickly as I could, but once I went to follow her, she was gone. Somewhere in between my house and the empty sand, Mary had disappeared. I assumed she ran ahead of me, headed into Mrs. Van Dyne's home, so I did the same. I found Mrs. Van Dyne amongst a group of children on the beach and said hello. We'd been neighbours for years, but I'd never really spoken to her. I told her I was a friend of Mary Barclay's. Mrs. Van Dyne's eyes went wide and she gripped my hands tightly. I'd never anticipated such a reaction. She sighed. "Oh, I'm so relieved. I didn't know what I was going to do with the children. I was sending Mrs. Barclay a telegram to tell her they were doing better when we received word." I looked around the beach, but Mary was gone. I wanted her to be here for whatever news is coming. I hid my fear and asked, "Word about what?" Mrs. Van Dyne looked at me incredulously.
"Word of her death."
The words were a blow to my sternum, and I stumbled back. Mrs. Van Dyne shook her head.
"The poor girl had been injured at the factory before, but a few short weeks later, her arm got caught in a machine. She bled out."
I wasn't sure what to say. Mary was just here. She was at my house.
The children don't need to know the details, of course, Mrs. Van Dyne added. When I looked at her strangely, she continued, Isn't that why you've come? To collect the children? As best I can tell you, you're the only friend she had. I swallowed, worrying I might never breathe again. Yes, of course. I offered Mary help, and some part of me knew something awful would happen if I broke my promise. Something as horrible and violent as Mary's infernal machines. I saw the accident in my mind, Mary's teary cry of so much blood. But perhaps even more terrifying than that was the sight of Mrs. Van Dyne bringing over two cherubic children, their hands outstretched in endless want. Smiling at me, their new mother. Up next, Anna's promise is more dangerous than she realizes.
Wayne Simmons spent 27 years undercover for the CIA. When he retired from spy work, he got a big break. Terrorism analyst on Fox News. Then he met Kent Clisby.
So I'm a real CIA guy. This is total nonsense.
I'm Alex French, and I'm here to figure out who's telling the truth. Was Wayne Simmons a spy, or was he nothing but a con man? Imposters is a Spotify original from Parcast and premieres Monday, May 3rd. Follow and listen exclusively on Spotify.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Now, back to the story. I settled Mary's account with Mrs. Van Dyne. It was the first step in a process I was not ready for. My dearest friend had returned from the dead to ask me to care for her children, and I could not say no, though I desperately wished I had. The children, Martha and Benny, came home with me. I let them sleep in the guest room. Perhaps sleep was an incorrect characterization, as they were endlessly amused by the feather mattress and took no small delight in bouncing up and down, even when they knew their mother was gone. Perhaps they were even more callous than Mary described. I left them to it and shut myself away to weep all night. My dearest friend was dead, and all I was left with was her children. The ones who did not care if their mother's hand was split open, as long as that hand set food on the table. Over the next few days, I tried to build a routine for them, but they were willful. Martha screamed any time I did something she didn't like, be it asking her to put on her shoes or telling her she couldn't play in the street. Benny ignored me completely. He asked every day when his mother was going to come back. I told him that she wouldn't, and he asked, why? Why indeed? I'd often wondered what motherhood would be like. In lighter moments, I even looked forward to the task of raising two little copies of my dearest friend. But these children had minds of their own and weren't afraid to use them. I'd find that inspiring in an adult. Arguing with a child on the merits of brushing one's teeth, however, was not nearly as adorable as I imagined. I never got enough sleep. On the rare occasions I did drift off, Martha rushed in to scream about horrific dreams of seeing Mary covered in blood. She insisted the only cure was to sleep alongside me. Her incessant kicks made it impossible for me to sleep through the night. I was doing my best. I told myself every day that I was learning to be a mother, which was no small feat. Yet I kept picturing the haunted look on Mary's face when she spoke about trying so hard and it never being enough. I had every advantage Mary didn't have, and I still felt like I was failing. At my most desperate hour, I begged God to send Mary back to me. One evening, I snapped awake at the kitchen table, face to face with a plate of cold chicken, grey mashed potatoes and sickly green peas. I didn't remember falling asleep, but I wasn't surprised. This was what exhaustion and boisterous children did to me. For one blessed moment, everything was silent. Oh, how I wished it could linger forever. There was simply not enough of it anymore. But my comfort curdled to unease as I realized that it was too silent for a house with two small children. I had visions of their bodies floating in the ocean and was terrified when I felt some relief at the notion. I was suddenly sure that my terrible fantasies would manifest some harm to them. My heart thundered as I ran from room to room. I flung open doors and screamed for Benny and Martha to show themselves, to end this hideous hide-and-seek. Suddenly, I heard giggles from behind my bedroom door. I felt relief and anger in the same breath. I was so glad they weren't swallowed by the tides, and so mad that they invaded my sanctuary. I opened the door and discovered that Benny and Martha had torn my clothes to pieces to make some sort of monster mask. I was stretched thin by their antics. I wanted nothing more than a strong drink and a nap. They would permit me neither, and I had to let out my rage. So I marched over and ripped the mask out of Benny's hands. "Stop it at once! These are my things! You are not to touch them! If you do it again, I'll break your things too! How would you like that? To be treated the way you treat me?" Martha started to cry. Benny charged at me and dug his fingernails into my flesh. I pushed him away, but he beat his fists against me. Suddenly, a voice barked into my ear. "Stop! Leave them be!" A chill ran down my back as I recognized the speaker. Mary. I whirled around and Benny screamed in horror. His mother was back, but not as he remembered her. Mary was not as I remembered her either. There was a foot-long gash in her torso and one of her arms was missing. But though blood oozed from her wounds, it never hit the floor. Then my gaze traveled to her face. One of her eyeballs had been split into two, her iris dark and distorted. I realized this was what Mary looked like when she died. Mrs. Van Dyne must have thought she was being kind to spare me with her vague description of Mary's injuries. But I was ill-equipped to handle this mutilated version of my friend. Still, I didn't believe you could flee from a ghost, so I had to make my stand.
"Mary, it's all right. I lost my temper for a moment. No one is harmed, except my wardrobe."
Mary ordered,
"You will not speak to them like that, Anna. You will not harm them. If I catch even an inkling that one tear has spilled from their eyes, I will make you regret it."
I was aghast at how she turned against me so quickly. I protested,
"Mary, they are children. We are not always going to agree, but sometimes there will be tears. But all of us are unharmed, I promise."
I looked down at Benny, transfixed by this new version of his mother. His lips trembled.
"Mommy, is that you?"
Mary softened.
"Yes, my child, it's me. Anna has offered to help, but I'm still here. I died for you, you beastly boy. And now I seem to be doomed to keep an eye on you for eternity. Tell me, Benny, does that frighten you? Do you even miss me?"
Benny clung to me, and I shared his fear. This was not the Mary I remembered. This Mary was a funhouse mirror of her former self, a manifestation of that dark desire I had to see the children lost at sea. The woman on my porch was desperate for a better life. This woman was shaped by her anger. She was no friend, not to me or her children. I pulled Benny behind me and told Martha to hide. I didn't want this perversion of their mother soiling their memories. Mary's intact eye narrowed, and a sudden, unseen force slammed me into the wall. Mary spat.
"You will not keep my children from me, Anna."
The room spun. I wasn't sure if I was on the ceiling or the floor. I searched for the children, but my eyes wouldn't focus. I felt my body slide down the wall and a small hand tugged at my dress.
"Miss Anna, I don't like this."
It was the first time Martha had spoken to me with any gentleness. She took my hand in hers. I whispered,
"It's all right, Martha. Your mother just misses you. She isn't herself."
I stopped talking when Mary's scarred hand gripped my throat. She shoved my head back into the wall. Little Martha squeezed my hand, and I drew strength from that. For the first time, we had a common goal. I looked Mary in the eye and tried to stay calm.
"Mary, this isn't you. Where is the girl carrying her books at Barnard, excited for life's possibilities? The smiling bride on her wedding day? There are other places to haunt. Your children are safe, and they will always be yours. But you are more than them, just as they are more than you."
The scarred hand fell away, and I slumped to the floor as little Martha held me tightly. As my vision cleared, I saw Mary shift forms once again. Now she looked like the ethereal woman who visited my porch. Martha and Benny ran over to her. If Mary had any doubts that her children hated her, they vanished. She took them into her arms and whispered
tearfully, "I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Now, mind your Aunt Anna. Be good. And remember me."
Then she kissed her children's heads and vanished. I never saw Mary again, but I felt her. I felt her when Benny hugged me, and when Martha fell helplessly in love with the girl next door. And I still feel her as the children have grown older. When Martha pushed her way into the boys' chess club at college, and when Benny became a lawyer to represent workers like his mother had been. Each time, a glimmer of moonlight told me Mary was watching, and she was proud of all of us. The substitute's title is a complicated one. Anna steps in for Mary as a parent, but the story also explores the gap between mothers and so-called old maids, and how we might wish to substitute one life for another. Anna wonders what her life might have been as a mother, while Mary frets about her parental shortcomings. But her plight is made darker by the fact that she resents her children too, or at least the tough life they were dealt. While alive, she felt guilt for seeing them as a burden, but in death, she is unable to let them go. It's no surprise that Georgia Wood Pangborn was raising children while she wrote the story, because underneath the thrills and chills of a horror story, she presents a simple, universal truth. Being a parent is a difficult, heart-wrenching experience, made even more so when you're a parent who's doing it alone. In Mary's case, her responsibility as a mother meant working herself to death. Anna decides to fulfill Mary's role despite these dangers, as so many women have before. She makes the choice with wistful but clear eyes, which is perhaps the most heartwarming moment of all. Mary has shown her friend the weight and the terror of the responsibility she is about to take on. And Anna takes it on all the same. Thanks again for tuning into Haunted Places Ghost Stories. We will be back on Thursday with a new episode. You can find more episodes of Ghost Stories and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify. See you on the other side. Haunted Places Ghost Stories is a Spotify original from Parcast. It is executive produced by Max Cutler, sound designed by Kenny Hobbs, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Trent Williamson, Carly Madden, and Erin Larson. This episode of Haunted Places Ghost Stories was written by Lil DeRitter and Jennifer Riche, with writing assistance by Alex Garland, fact-checking by Audriana Romero, and research by Mickey Taylor. I'm Alastair Murden.